Tonight we talk about Planet X, that object that could be in our solar system somewhere. Floating format for you tonight, two guests. This hour, Jason Martell joins us. I'll explain who he is and what he brings to this incredible story in a moment. And then next hour, Eric Parker joins us. Then in the last hour, the hour that you make your phone calls, both Jason and Eric will join in. Jason Martell is next on Coast to Coast AM. Jason Martell, world-renowned researcher, lecturer specializing in the ancient Sumerian culture, Sumer's advanced technology, and how it relates to Planet X. Backed by leading scientists from the mainstream scientific community, Mr. Martell has appeared on many television and radio programs. Looking forward, Mr. Martell is preparing to conduct several groundbreaking international research expeditions. His goal is always to gain firsthand access to ancient Sumerian artifacts and other archaeological relics not currently accessible to you. By bringing worldwide attention to these hidden artifacts, Mr. Martell hopes to usher in a new era in the ancient astronaut theory. Jason Martell. Jason, always a pleasure. How are you?
Hi, George, Nori. Wow, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Too long. We got to get you back more often, my friend.
Oh, thank you, sir.
One of the topics so dear to my heart, and a friend of mine out at the NighthawkZone.com, Bad Boy, I think he stays up all week when he knows you're on, because the ancient astronaut theory is incredible. Tell me a little about what you've been doing, though, since you were last on with me December 2006, right?
I believe so. It's kind of been a while,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it has. What have you been doing in between?
Well, you know, keeping busy as usual. I have been doing, I've been fortunate enough to do a little bit of traveling. And I did speak in Brazil last year, you know, about the ancient astronaut research. So, you know, I was trying to just stay on the cusp of the story of, you know, breaking news for things that happen, archaeological discoveries, things that we can tie in to get a clearer picture for using modern science and look at the ancient knowledge, the ancient evidence in a new light.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. And talking about breaking news,
yes.
Not too long ago, Japanese group of researchers from Kobe University said that they believe that there could be a Planet X in the solar system. What do you think of that?
I think it's some very exciting news. You know, obviously, George, you and I have been going back and forth on this esoteric topic, the idea of another planet in our solar system. The modern science today would label it a 10th planet, meaning, you know, we have 9 planets, Pluto being 9th, there'd be a planet beyond Pluto. So it's very interesting that, once again, we have a resurgence in the scientific astronomical community for a focus to say, gentlemen, there is possibly another object in our solar system. So this, of course, raises the eyebrow of researchers like myself who, you know, for many reasons are interested in why would we even be looking for a planet in our solar system. But for a long time now, even since 1930, when Pluto was first discovered, we've been looking for a Planet X. So it hasn't been an established astronomical norm yet, and it's great to see for researchers like myself and others who are interested in this topic that it is resurfacing again in the astronomical community.
You know, 5 years ago, I would say, Jason, the mere mention of a Planet X in the solar system would have been scoffed at by most astronomers.
Sure.
I don't think the majority would do that anymore. What do you think?
Yes, well, you know, we've had, the thing is the reason why this topic has gotten so convoluted, and we'll explain to the listeners tonight why we're even talking about a Planet X, but anyone who's followed this topic, ever since around 2004, this started to make headlines again, and it hadn't since the early 80s. We started to see things out in the, you know, in our solar system beyond Pluto, where astronomers, for instance, found Xena or Quowar. And these are basically just large chunks of ice, very large chunks of ice, floating beyond Pluto, so large, in fact, that we can't classify them as a planet, but we call them planetoids. So there's been a debate to say, well, you know, you found these large chunks of ice. Is it a planet? Is it not? The point is that we're developing technology, astronomical infrared technology with our telescopes, so we're starting to get a clearer picture of what possibly could be out there. And ever since the early 80s, we've had information to suggest there is a Planet X.
I've got Michael Cremo on as a guest, Jason, Wednesday night. His theory, of course, is that humankind, much older than what we think, millions of years older. So if I were to ask him an ancient astronaut question, he would talk about it in terms of ancient astronauts from this planet who went to the moon and probably elsewhere. You, on the other hand, and when we talk with Eric next hour, you believe ancient astronauts are those that also came here, right?
That is correct. Now, one of the very pivotal points of why, you know, a topic of Planet X is so interesting, at least for someone like myself, is most modern astronomers might not be aware that there's also ancient references, which we'll discuss tonight, for a Planet X, meaning we're using modern science and, you know, astronomy to detect, hey, there's a planet that we're still undetected. We should, we should be able to find it. It turns out there's actual astronomical sources from ancient knowledge, just like, for instance, the Mayans had very accurate astronomical data. Recently in the movie Apocalypto by Mel Gibson, they portrayed how the Mayans, the priest knew that the solar solstice was going to happen, and at that exact time, you know, they tricked the people or showcased to the people that they had the power of, like, you know, controlling the sun. Well, in fact, the Sumerians, even well before the Mayans, also had amazing astronomical knowledge, which now we can prove, and part of that data includes another planet within our solar system.
Well, let's get into this then, this Planet X and the possibility. What do you think it is, first of all, Jason, this Planet X?
Well, George, here's another interesting thing, again, using modern science to confirm the ancient knowledge. A lot of the new research that we're starting to do, first of all, astronomers wouldn't even accept the idea that a planet could be on a highly elliptical orbit. Now, the ancient records from the Sumerian culture speak of a planet on a very highly elliptical orbit. And they, you know, cite all the other planets in our solar system accurately, the color of the planets, the distance of the planets. So this mention of this additional body really starts to raise questions for, you know, does it exist? And, you know, we only discovered Pluto in 1930 using advanced mathematics and the telescope. And even then, there were what we call perturbations on the outer planets, meaning something is pulling the planets in a certain direction, but we can't account for what that large mass could be. So there's just all types of theories abound, and one of the most recent ones, which I thought was kind of interesting, is actually two. First of all, there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Mueller over at Berkeley University, and he postulated that there's basically another failed sun, like most solar systems that have been imaged by Hubble.
A binary star system?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Have been shown, external solar systems imaged by Hubble have been shown to be binary, two suns. So then that raised the question, well, what if our solar system is binary, but our other sun, if you will, is a failed sun, what we call a brown dwarf? So Dr. Mueller at Berkeley postulated that there's another planet, which he called Nemesis, that orbits this failed sun billions of miles out. And in the process of its orbit around our failed sun, the second sun, it would dislodge comets and debris from something called the Oort cloud. It's like another asteroid belt way out on the perimeter of our solar system. And so he theorized that this Nemesis orbiting the brown dwarf, our failed sun, would dislodge comets and debris over millions of years. And this is what might have caused the asteroids or comets to strike Earth, causing the great dinosaur extinction. So there's many planetary models or hypotheses abound using modern science saying that it is possible that there could be another planet within our own solar system. So it makes it a very interesting, you know, story, George, as we get into this, to show that the modern science is accurate. There is sufficient data to say, hey, there's another planet out there. We just haven't found it yet.
And there could be countless numbers of other planets in this solar system, Jason.
Yes, there could. Yes, there could. That's where kind of the data, you know, from the 1980s, there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Harrington that started to do plots using, you know, astronomical telescopes. At the time, we had one called IRAS, the Infrared Astronomical Satellite. And he would, you know, make star charts, plots, take images of the sky, and they would have to go through and chart which stars were already recognized and which ones could be possible new candidates. And so even since the early 80s, they've been trying to pinpoint candidates for which objects would possibly be a star that might be still within our own solar system. But it's a very hard thing to do, you know, when we consider that, you know, space is three-dimensional and it's there's a lot of space out there.
True. So this Planet X, Jason, could be responsible for a lot of calamities that occurred on this planet.
Yes, it could be, and for a lot of the anomalies that we see within our own solar system.
Okay, how about the Great Flood, the flood that we can, you know, talk about Noah, for example? Might that have been caused by a Planet X getting too close to the planet?
Yes, it could. Now, that's where, again, the stories get very interesting, because we have a crossover from modern and ancient knowledge. There is a Sumerian culture, today's modern-day Iraq, 6,000 years ago. We've heard of Mesopotamia, Babylon, but 6,000 years ago, Sumer, where today's modern-day Iraq is, first civilization shows up. And this civilization creates over 100 of the firsts for a civilization that would be a high society. And interestingly enough, many of the tales that they recorded in the first written language, called cuneiform script, literally right out of the Stone Age, the first written language, this culture has a very advanced mathematics, astronomy, and everything that they say, they say that they learned from beings that came from another planet within our solar system. They called it Nibiru. Now, the kicker of why this is interesting is this Sumerian legacy, this information they've left us on stone tablets, mind you, meaning their writing was left on stone tablets unchanged to this day, speak of many tales that parallel modern biblical information. And one of those, of course, is a great flood. So we have, for instance, in Genesis, a story of Noah being chosen by God to build an ark. And, this whole story plays out. It lands on a mountain. They send out the dove. He brings back a branch. Well, there's actually a Sumerian derivative, a stone version of this tale.
Oh, my, yeah.
Yes, and it's 4,000 years before the Christian version. And it's stored in the British Museum as the Flood Tablet. It's written in this cuneiform script, and it speaks of how another planet, a much larger planet, was pulled into our part of the solar system and became a permanent member of our solar system on a highly elliptical orbit. And early on, the Sumerians have a very detailed description. Just like in Genesis, there are 7 days of creation. Well, the Sumerians have seven stone tablets of creation that also tell the story in a much longer format, which also include this additional planet that, as you eloquently mentioned, they described having, you know, a large part of our solar system's formation, which also included, let's say, 4.7 billion years ago or so, an encounter with our primitive Earth that over time, as it orbits through our solar system, it has caused effects on Earth. And one of those was when it passed by Earth the last time, let's say roughly 4,000 years ago, it's theorized that it cracked off one of the glaciers, you know, the ice sheets in Antarctica, instantly raising the water levels around the world 300 feet.
What about Atlantis, going back even before the flood, if it existed? Might that have been caused by a calamity when this so-called Planet X came around during that time period?
Well, that's a really good question, George. You know, that's definitely where my research is leading me, is everyone has heard of the idea of Atlantis, you know, and they think of some advanced culture that lived on a continent that somehow sunk, and I don't see it that way. My research shows me that if there was a highly technological civilization before the epoch era that we can pinpoint now as saying, you know, which we're talking about tonight, the Sumerians 6,000 years ago, right out of the Stone Age, we have the evidence. There is actually evidence all over the world, on every continent, huge pyramidal structures or megalithic monuments that suggest there must have been some advanced technological culture, 10,000, 15,000 BC, that we still can't pinpoint. Yet, if there was a technologically advanced civilization, they wouldn't have been on a continent. They would have been a worldwide civilization. So it is a very interesting correlation, George, that we see the pyramids in Egypt and their astronomical connection, for instance, to the Orion constellation and the pyramids in Mexico having astronomical alignments. Maybe there have been some type of cataclysmic events that didn't just wipe out the Sumerians. They wiped out life worldwide. But it's been very hard to pinpoint even accepting a global flood because archaeologists and, the worldwide accepted view for did a flood even take place. No one can accurately prove that with science yet.
You know how the book of Revelation talks about wormwood, and, you know, it really doesn't give us the exact idea what wormwood could be, whether it's a planet, comet, asteroid. It is some kind of, I believe, celestial object. But could wormwood be a Planet X that creates this havoc whenever it gets close?
Well, I think so. You know, there's an interesting correlation here with again, you know, what we're going to talk about is Sumerian references to a planet X, and these all predate all of the English or the Old Testament versions of stories that we have from biblical information. So we really have an interesting piece of this story to start with when we look at the fact that, you know, in the early 1900s, British archaeologists started doing excavations in Iraq. And in the early, we're talking like 1890 through 1910, let's say, really early 1900s, they're pulling out tablets from Iraq that show what the Sumerians called Anunnaki, basically angels, if you will. They gave the term Anunnaki, which translates into those who from heaven come to earth. And they had all these other tablets that, for instance, described the orbital patterns of the planets, distance between the planets. They talked about this additional planet, Planet X, Nibiru. And so in the early 1900s, remember, we didn't discover Pluto till 1930, all these archaeologists seeing this information about Anunnaki and living on Nibiru and Planet X, they put all of this into a big myth pile. They didn't understand. They didn't understand these references. So even to this day, we have a disconnect where archaeologists and the astronomers aren't talking, and that we see an obvious disconnect where they don't recognize any of the ancient sources as scientific data. It's mythology, meaning it's some culture that's making up a story to explain their origins or their beliefs and, you know, their creation story. However, when we start to apply, you know, at least focusing on this amazing data from the Sumerian culture, when we apply science, a lot of the stories start to take new shape.
Jason, the Planet X in Nibiru discussions that have been held for, gosh, ages, do we believe if these ancient astronauts came from that planet, might they still be there now? Is the planet dead? What do you think is going on with those extraterrestrials?
Well, it's a very hard question to answer. Sure. You know, even with our sciences, again, you know, there's kind of a line in the dirt that says very simply, modern academia is not willing to accept the idea that extraterrestrials exist now or ever have, period. So if you can get beyond that, you can see this information being relayed by the Sumerians about this culture for, you know, coming from a planet X. And, it's very hard to prove. But again, George, when we start to use science to confirm some of these stories, it starts to raise your eyebrow a little. For instance, this idea of a planet X, you know, the Sumerians say that this planet is on a very highly elliptical orbit, kind of like a large egg-shaped
3,600 year.
3,600 right. Years, correct. So if you understand that all of our planets, meaning, for instance, Earth, it goes around the sun once every 365 days. That's a solar year. Nibiru goes around our sun once every 3,600 of our years. That's one solar year for Nibiru. So a lot of the answers to, you know, how could a planet like that, that goes so deep into space, support life? Where's the heat source? How does this happen? Again, the science starts to answer that question. If we are a binary solar system, and as Image pointed out, by imaging other external solar systems, it saw the first planet around another star actually was on an elliptical orbit, it starts to raise the idea that, well, maybe our planet X is orbiting so far into the depths of space that it goes towards that other second sun and loops back around towards us. Now, Nibiru is described by the Sumerian culture to be a very red, glowing planet. And they described that the Anunnaki living on this planet, they're gods, just like the Bible says, we were created in their image and after their likeness. These Anunnaki stated to the Sumerians that they came here originally to repair Nibiru's dwindling atmosphere, meaning they said that their planet, on the Anunnaki's rise to their own technological civilization, they've messed up Nibiru's atmosphere. So that was one of the reasons why they came here to Earth originally, was to mine gold, which we'll discuss further.
Absolutely. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, next hour, Eric Parker joins us. He is the webmaster for Zechariah Sitchin. Zechariah's website, Sitchin.com, and we'll continue then to talk more about Planet X. When I come right back, Jason Martell on Coast to Coast AM. Jason, so they needed to mine gold from this planet. God knows how many tons of gold they pulled out of here and sprinkled it up in their atmosphere. And you think it worked?
That's a good question. You know, did it work? Will we ever meet these Anunnaki? Are they still are they still inhabiting Nibiru or Planet X? So hopefully our modern science will find this planet, because, you know, if we do find a planet 4 to 8 times the size of Earth, not just some chunk of ice floating out there beyond Pluto, 4 to 8 times the size of Earth is the descriptions by the Sumerians, a big red glowing planet. Could even be seen by day. They have stone tablets which show, for instance, a Sumerian plowing a field. They were the first ones to have agriculture, by the way, too.
Mm-hmm.
You see them plowing a field, you see the sun, and they're looking up in awe at the glowing red cross in the sky. Another interesting fact, 4,000 years before Christianity, they depicted the home world of their gods as a glowing cross. And the term Nibiru actually means planet of the crossing. Another interesting little fact, George, is, you know, the Sumerians describe Planet X, Nibiru, as having, you know, this highly elliptical orbit, and it passes through currently where our asteroid belt is. Now, part of the stories of the Sumerian tales of this planet describe how, let's say around 4.5 billion, 4.7 billion years ago, Planet X, one of the moons of Planet X, whacked our primitive Earth and caused the asteroid belt, meaning it whacked our primitive Earth in such a way that it strewed out this asteroid belt, leaving our Earth to be a, let's call it half a planet, and moved it into the orbit it's now in today. And that's another interesting correlation where when we look at, for instance, the idea of Pangaea, that Earth at one point was all one connected landmass.
Right, and it cracked or something.
Right, like the skin of an apple, only the skin has come apart, but the actual landmass was just one chunk of land, which supports the idea, I mean, if you siphon off all the water, Pangaea, one chunk of mass of land, that it would have been just half a planet. Where's the other half? The Sumerians describe saying that Planet X, Nibiru, in this initial collision, or the moons of Nibiru in a collision with Earth, caused the asteroid belt. But here's an interesting little thing that a lot of the ufology people out there will find interesting. So the modern orbit of Planet X would take it through Mars and Jupiter. Between Mars and Jupiter is where the asteroid belt is. So we're talking about a 12th planet passing between Mars and Jupiter. We'll look at this. Mars, MJ for Jupiter,
mm-hmm.
MJ, 12th planet, 12th, MJ 12. Now, that was just an interesting correlation, I thought. But, you know, again, there is data, which we'll talk about here from the Sumerian epic, that they were aware of 12 members in our solar system. Modern astronomical terms for Planet X simply mean X is numeric 10, but also unknown. The Planet X of the Sumerians described a solar system, our solar system, with 12 members. They counted the 9 planets we know of, our sun, 10, our moon, 11, and then Nibiru, the 12th planet of the homeworld of the Anunnaki. And that number 12 is very key, and I'm sure Eric, who I'm sure is listening, will have a lot of information to share on this too, but a lot of the things that the Sumerians left us in their lexicon of information, meaning, again, they were the first culture right out of the Stone Age, and we still use a lot of the things that they've left us in the form of math, time, medicine, science. So this idea of a solar system with 12 members, listen to how many references this has filtered down into. Again, these are all Sumerian firsts.
Well, also, there's no doubt that these Sumerians, when they came to our planet, made us in their own form. Don't you think they genetically altered something here to make us look like them?
That's exactly it. If you were to ask a Sumerian man, how do you know all this advanced math and astronomy and courts and systems of laws and judges, school, where did you learn all this? They say all that we know, we were taught by the Anunnaki, which simply means those who from heaven come to earth. And they describe a time when they lived amongst their actual living gods. Just like it says in the Bible, there were giants upon the earth. So there's a lot of interesting similarities when we start to look at this information that can cross over again to our, you know, our modern use of this story. For instance, when we talk about 12 members of the solar system, 12 hours in the day, 12 hours in the night, 12 inches in a foot, 12 in a dozen. Some of the biblical references, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples of Jesus, the 12 Greek Olympians. All of this is a derivative from the original Sumerian information of 12 planets in our solar system, and they were the first ones to divide the heavens into 12 parts.
Is this a code?
It almost sounds like it, like
it does.
Some Da Vinci code or something. But no, this is real, George. This is the real data of most people would credit math, high math, and science to the Greeks and the Romans. However, they all cite Mesopotamian references, Sumer. So there is just a lot of academic information that can collaborate the legitimacy for what the Sumerians were saying. However, there's that line in the dirt again. When the Sumerians start to talk about their interaction with their living gods as real, live, daily events that took place, our archaeologists and linguists today aren't willing to accept that this was factual data. It's mythology. So we're taking the standpoint to say these are events that have really taken place. An ancient man living in clay huts and using stone tools had no idea to say, wow, that's advanced technology. That's a human being coming down in some type of anti-gravitic device, and he's an extraterrestrial. No. They simply said, wow, that must be a god, and he has some conveyance for the power of flight, so we give him wings. But we see even that connection today, George, you know, where even today we're seeing things in our skies, and there are reports of things like alien abductions, where we can't put our finger on it. So today we call them aliens, whereas then they called them gods. But maybe these are the same, and there's a crossover here.
Why did they leave this planet?
Well, that's a very esoteric topic, and I think the answer from my own personal view, I can't give you substantial data, would say that they probably never left. And the reason for that is, you know, the current state of world affairs on Earth right now is that if there is an advanced extraterrestrial race that has, you know, involved an involvement with our past, they're looking at us and seeing us killing ourselves and blowing up the planet and dwindling natural resources. What advantage would we have with, you know, the introduction of more advanced technology? So all these stories we hear of classified research or Area 51 or, you know, a cover-up, it starts to make sense that if you put into the perspective the inclusion of, you know, alien technology, what would that do to the stock market? What would it do if all of a sudden you could buy some little generator the size of a quarter and power your home forever? They're not going to let that type of stuff out. So I can understand some of the real-life applications for if there are aliens and advanced technology, which we hear on the fringes all along for over 50 years, we've been reverse engineering it, it makes sense that this stuff is so amazing and so beneficial that it has to be released in phases, slowly desensitizing the public to the idea that, you know, even for religious purposes, society just isn't quite ready. We're getting there to accept the idea that, you know, we're not the masters of our domain.
How do you think humans during this era, the Sumerians specifically, picked up some of the technology that the Anunnaki, of course, brought to them, but did they train them? Did they leave behind instruments, telescopes? What do you think happened then?
Well, the Sumerians, you know, were very, very interesting in that what they have left us is a daily recorded, you know, recordings of their daily lives and events. So there are thousands of stone tablets with a written language and cylinder seals with basically little pictures. They called them pictograms, and they would roll these seals in wet clay and leave the positive imprint of the image. So they had all these pictures and texts that would describe their daily events where they very specifically described they lived amongst their living gods. And so, you know, to ask where they went or, you know, what happened to the Sumerians, or will we ever even meet these Anunnaki again, all we have is the recorded data that shows their daily lives included interaction with these beings, the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki basically would work with very select high priests of the city and scribes, you know, who would work with the priest. A scribe was someone who could read and write Sumerian. The Anunnaki would literally dictate to a high priest and a scribe present information, stories, data. So we have information actually, you know, bequeathed by Anunnaki, you know, for all intents and purposes, an extraterrestrial being, and is telling and, you know, relaying this to Sumerians that have, you know, copied all this information down. And, you know, we have tablets stored in the British Museum where modern archaeologists have translated this information, and it's there as a record for us all to, you know, to look at. Now, Zachariah Sitchin and a few other linguists have stepped outside the norm of accepted archaeology, instead of saying, what's the meaning of this one phrase or this one word, to say that all the information in a grander context starts to show, what if this information is truth, not just mythology? What if these are events that took place? And the reason why we take that position is all the information they've left us, which we can prove with the scientific advances we have today about astronomy or medicine or astrology, if you want to even, you know, include that as science, but the division of the heaven in 12 parts, all these things that we can understand today, we have to start to put into perspective what the Sumerians are saying about the other information we can't understand yet, which is the involvement of extraterrestrials and their their very deep involvement with our past and probable future.
You know, this 3,600-year orbit, of course, in terms of speculating if there is a Planet X, where it might be now, and how close will it come and when, Jason?
Well, that's the money question, George. Is obviously, you know, since you and I have become aware of the idea of a Planet X, we've heard all types of predicted dates, rumors, hypotheses, if I could be so nice to say that, of when Planet X, Nibiru, would return. 2000, 2003, 2007, and now it's 2012. So I personally do not give any weight to say that Planet X is connected to 2012 or it's coming back anytime soon. And the reason why is we're talking about a planet 4 to 8 times the size of Earth. Now, the professional and the amateur astronomy community has always been very astute at finding stuff. Hail Bopp, Shoemaker-Levy 9, that, you know, blasted into Jupiter, where NASA said it wasn't going to be anything. We had amateur astronomers recording unbelievable explosions as the 9 debris hit Jupiter. So there's a lot of things that happen that, you know, we will, if this planet is going to be coming back anytime within our lifetimes, we'll see it. And I don't think it's something that you can cover up. If it does come back, will it cause gravitational effects or a great flood like it has in the past? No one knows. The only answer I can say to that, George, is if we look at the math, the science, to say that roughly 4.7 billion years ago is when initially Planet X became a permanent member of our solar system, and if it has a 3,600-year orbit, we divide 4.7 billion by 3,600, and we're looking at over 1 million orbits Nibiru has already completed where it would be passing, as we discussed, at MJ-12. Between Mars and Jupiter. So I think personally that if Planet X even were to pass by us within our lifetime, it could be on, for instance, the other side of the sun, and the Earth's on the other side of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and we can't see it.
We can't even see it. It might not have the type of effects it has in the past. We just don't know. But it is a very interesting topic to look at for what could happen in the future when we hear things like wormwood or, you know, in the revelations of Armageddon and we tie in the information as the Sumerians have described it of how this has caused a great flood in the past. It does raise an eyebrow of concern, but my own personal belief is that we won't find Planet X anywhere near us. And my interest, George, in this topic is not that Planet X is coming to kill us or when is it going to come and cause a great flood. It's the beings that live on this planet.
Absolutely.
And if they do exist, that's who I want to meet. And the correlation of Planet X being in the proximity to Earth doesn't always mean that that's when they visited us. The Sumerians were very astute in describing how, you know, the Anunnaki actually used Mars as well as a way station.
Why did they disappear, though, Jason? Why did they leave?
The only answer I can derive is from the research by Zachariah Sitchin at this point, which describes the Anunnaki having feuds, you know, family clans amongst each other rising to power. And all the things in our past where we would worship the different idols of different gods, when the Anunnaki, for some reason, started to squabble amongst each other, they had a nuclear war and eventually decided to no longer inhabit Earth after the Great Flood, after the Great Deluge.
It's great to know, by the way, no matter how advanced one gets on this in this universe,
yes,
they'll still blow themselves up.
Yes.
Jeez.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's something that over time we're going to keep an eye on, and if Planet X is something that exists, the kicker of the information is we might actually have ancestors. And, you know, I think through our own progression of how this story would play out, desensitizing the public to, you know, extraterrestrials, we are already on a timetable now for the inclusion of, you know, when I was in high school, water anywhere beyond Earth was not even possible. All the planets were basically dirt. But now it's an accepted norm. Water on the moon, water on Mars, water on most of the outer planets. So hopefully within our lifetime, you know, we'll be able to confirm, for instance, in baby steps, how about some bacteria on Mars? Some little animal that's living on a comet that we'll find. And then eventually they'll open up the idea that, wow, just as life is thriving here on Earth, even where there isn't any sunlight and the thermal vents deep in the ocean, life is probably abundant in our own solar system. But we have to be, we have to come into this information as gradual steps. So, you know, there are definitely some points of interest for people to learn about the topic of ufology. And what I've recommended is that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So looking at the ancient sources, biblical tales, things that we accept as very sacred information, when looked at in a new light, every culture around the world, every culture, points to the heavens to say our gods came from the skies. Is heaven just floating around up there as some mythical spot? We don't know. This starts to, you know, lead a new line of thinking to say, let's use modern science to confirm ancient knowledge. Besides, if Anunnaki or beings live on other worlds, somebody had to create them, and that just goes to show that there's probably a much larger encompassing view of our world and the idea that it's not just black and white, you know, God created us in his image and after his likeness, and that's it. I think there's a much larger picture. So it is very interesting information to look at this Sumerian data and scientifically start to confirm it doesn't go away. Every new advancement we find is only further confirming the information left by the Sumerian lexicon of information.
2012. It's right around the corner. And you think Planet X might be there too?
I do not.
You do not.
I think Planet X is something that, you know, if it's going to happen in our lifetime, we'll see it. 2012 is a topic that's come up because the Mayans, who are also very astute astronomical observers, they made predictions. Now, not on their Gregorian-style calendar. They had something called a long-count calendar where they made predictions. One of those predictions in the past was our gods are going to return at a certain date. The gods didn't return. Kukulkan didn't come back. The conquistadors showed up and aggressively converted the Mayans to Christianity and destroyed all the codices. So they've predicted in the future, in 2012, that there'll be the end of time as they understood it. We don't understand what that means or even can give any reference because their predictions in the past haven't always come true. So it's kind of an unclear picture, and people have started to, you know, speculate and try and tie two and two together, Wormwood, Mayan 2012, Planet X. That's when it's coming back. We don't have any substantial data to say when that's going to happen or what effects it will have once it does.
I wonder if the second coming also relates to the Anunnaki.
It's good stuff, George. It's good stuff. I mean, we're talking about very, you know, a lot of people around the world. You know, I'm one of the 4 million. I was raised as a Christian, you
sure.
know, and I just happen to be one of the 4 million people
I'm
in the
believer.
U.S. alone, right, that, you know, maybe there's life beyond
oh,
Earth.
Yeah. You can believe in a divine power and also extraterrestrial life.
Amen, of course.
You know, in the early days when we were growing up, you know, you weren't supposed to, but I think it's widely accepted. The Vatican even accepts the fact that there could be life out
Balducci,
there.
Balducci, yes.
And many more. I think privately there are many, many theologians and religious leaders who believe that there are extraterrestrial life out there, and maybe even visitations.
Well, again, you know, the only thing, final, you know, wrap-up I'd start to leave for our conversation in this hour, George, is that all these biblical tales that we have, which Eric will touch on from his being raised as a Hebrew, I being raised as a Christian, have looked at these stories in the New King James Version of the, you know, the New Testament
sure.
and such. And I've always found a connection with saying, wow, this is so interesting, but how can we use our understandings of science to start to factually prove some of this data? And, you know, the Anunnaki are the only beings throughout history that I have been able to physically have references to cite as actual beings that existed and are a part of our history that are not from Earth.
Well, next hour we'll talk about us. Okay, Jason, we'll see you in an hour. Give me an Arnold, would you?
All right, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Supposed to say, I'll be back. We'll be back. Eric Parker, the webmaster for www.sitchin.com, the official webmaster of the author, Zechariah Sitchin. Eric began studying the Bible in Hebrew at an early age. By 1997, he began to read and hear Mr. Sitchin, who specializes, of course, in comparative studies of the ancient world. Eric was intrigued by Sitchin's perspective that the key to humanity's past lives in the ancient Mesopotamia, particularly the written descriptions of extraterrestrial gods. And we're going to bring in Eric now, and he will be with us next hour along with Jason Martell when we take your phone calls. Eric, how have you been?
Well, it's been a rough time with the markets and everything else that's been going
yeah,
on.
You're a stockbroker by the daytime, aren't you?
That is correct, yes.
It is a difficult time for you guys. My gosh, I mean, are your clients like going crazy? Do they call all the time? What's going on?
Well, really, some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them are calm, some of them are not as calm. Everybody has their own personality. But overall, I would say that they're pretty good.
Well, that's another story. We'll bring you back in on another day for that, huh?
Yep.
How did you get involved with Zachariah Sitchin?
Well, it's funny. The first time I heard about Zachariah was actually on Coast to Coast AM.
Ah.
And he did the first hour of the show. And because of my background in studying the Bible in Hebrew, I was intrigued by what he was saying with the words like Elohim and other words that were in Hebrew and maybe mistranslated or came from older sources. And so I bought his books and I started to read the material, and I was blown away by what kind of information it had and how scholarly it was.
His books are classics, aren't they, Eric?
Well, they're incredible. And you know what? Back when I started in 97 with his stuff, he already had written about 7 or 8 books. So there was a lot of material to cover up to that point that I had missed, because his first book was published in 1976, I believe, the 12th Planet, or 77. So then I went to see him in Sedona, Arizona, signed up to go on trips with him, and lo and behold, I started to travel with him on many group trips that went all over the world.
Good for you. How's he feeling these days?
He's okay. He's pulling through the changes that happen in life when you get older.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully we're going to be taking a trip to Italy soon, if that works out.
Well, he does have some energy then, doesn't he?
Oh, yes, he does.
Now, tell me a little bit about what you do. I know you're the webmaster, and, of course, knowing what our webmaster Lex does, of course, it's yeoman's work. He never stops. Tell me what you do with Sitchin.com.
Well, Sitchin.com is a little bit less active than I would say your Coast to Coast show is, or your website is. But for many years, we did seminars, and we advertised them there. The website, Sitchin.com, is a platform for Zachariah to produce articles and keep people up to date with things that are being discovered, let's say on Mars or different scientific discoveries with the Human Genome Project and other things that he wrote about many, many years ago, or things that corroborate or confirm things that he studied on his own.
Let's talk about some of his work, Eric, because I truly believe it is a classic work. When I heard about the 12th planet, probably around 96 or so as well, I just digest myself into his work, jump right into it. When you started studying it, I mean, how did you react to it? I mean, was it fascinating to you? Did you think, oh my gosh, this is a fairy tale? What happened?
Well, it was actually like a light bulb going off in my head. And I realized that his basic premise, which is very simple, is that the ancients recorded the information that they had, and they didn't write fantasies or create fiction. They simply recorded things as the best way they could speak them or describe them in written form, using old language and sometimes poetry and things like this. So it sounded fantastical to many people, but when I saw how he went backwards through the language tree and corroborated some of the mistranslations with the original meanings of words, I knew that I had found an author who really was on top of his game and his material. Because basically what we find is that when you go through the record, you could find the originating source of most words and stories. As Jason mentioned before, most of them come from the Sumerian culture as an original source for the stories and different concepts. Like Jason mentioned, 100 firsts that were noted in Sumerian tablets. What was unique about the Sumerian culture was that they left almost 1 million tablets behind.
1 million tablets?
If you count up everything. And what was different back then in the history was when one nation state conquered another, let's say it became became Sumerian, then Akkadian, then Babylonian, they did not wipe out the culture that they conquered. In fact, they would copy all the material. And so you have different versions of the same stories with different character names, and each one's in a different language or a different style, and you can follow and go back to where the source is. That's why the material is so compelling, because it's overwhelming type 1 data or type 1 evidence. And type 1 is something physical, like a tablet that's in clay or stone that has not been changed since the time that the scribe chiseled it.
I was going to say, describe for us, if you would, Eric, these tablets, what they look like, how they were made.
Well, very simple. By the way, if anybody has access to a website, on my site, ericparker.com, I have on the website called webradio.hdm.
And that's colors. Eric with a K.
That's right? Correct. Yeah, Eric Parker with a K in all case. Basically, you're talking about tablets that are the size of pieces of paper, 8.5 by 11, up to the sizes of, you know, pillow sizes of tablets that they carved stories on and they carved transactions on, like I sold you some sheep and, you know, we did some land transaction. Most of them are these kind of administrative tablets. But remember, back then, if the king wanted to get out his edict and tell a story or give some rules or laws, it had to be copied throughout the kingdom. So he would put on these tablets whatever he wants.
Made out of what?
Either clay or stone.
Okay.
And so they will survive in their original form until they're broken or smashed or, you know, cave in some cases, destroys it. It's not like a piece of paper, like our books. If you just sit around with the books for a few hundred years and you try to look at them,
yeah,
they will fall apart.
Fall apart, sure.
So what you've got is the original form that the scribe wrote, and it's chiseled, and with the clay, they used the stylus while the clay was wet. In the case of stone, they would chisel it, you know, with a hammer and the chisel. And you have this, the most amazing stories that we are all familiar with today, but we're familiar with them from the Bible.
Okay, so these stories were primarily depictions of little sketches. Is that what they would do?
Well, no, actually, these are extremely long, detailed stories. For example, in the Epic of Creation, which is seven tablets, the seven tablets of creation, it has a lot more information of why humans were created than what you see in the Bible. And the stories the Bible borrows from these older Sumerian sources, it actually edits them down to smaller versions.
But they don't have texts. They don't have words. So it's pictures, right?
Well, no, they have both. They depict, they have many depictions which appear in cylinder seals and just carved on stelas, which is a giant stone with a carving. And then you have a story which matches the picture. So in some cases, you get a cylinder steel showing the first mother goddess holding up the first human male, and she's saying, my God, my hands have made it. And then you also have a text which describes this event and how it came to be. So you have corroborating evidence, picture form, and this text in the same culture describing the same thing.
If five people, Eric, looked at the texts, mm-hmm, and in the you know, the pictures, would they come up with five different stories or interpretations?
No, I think they would all come up with the same story, but they would have a different reasoning behind the story's originating source. For example, the flood story. Now, I know of the Noah flood character by four different names: Atrahasis, Utnapishtim, and Zeasudra, and Noah. Those are all four names of the same character who was told by his God to get ready for a flood and build an ark, and then he escapes the flood with his family. It's the same story. The names change through the different cultural changes, and the story will always be the same, the theme of the story. But each culture kind of made the story themselves when changed very small things. For example, the Bible has the dove catching the little branch from the tree. In the Sumerian story, the raven gets the branch. And the water is not 150 days, and they're not on the ark for that long of time. It's something like 7 days. So different changes occur, but the stories are basically the same themes. But there's a lot more details in the Sumerian story. It describes the gods looking down upon the humans who have died in the flood and lamenting and feeling upset and crying for their humans who have been killed.
Okay, now, of course, the big story, Eric, and that is the Anunnaki and Nibiru and the visitation. Describe to me what these tablets look like and how we interpret that, how Zechariah did specifically.
Well, what Zechariah did was very simple. When all the scholars were looking at these and saying, well, these are just fantasy stories made up, he said, wait a second, there's more information in here that can't be just by chance. There must be some knowledgeable source or originating person or God in this case, because that's what they said in the stories, that it was their God who gave them this information, because more information is shown. There's a tablet that divides numbers of 12,960,000, and it divides that number down to the smallest part possible. Now, why does anybody 6,000 years ago need to be dealing with numbers in the 12 millions? I don't know. But besides that kind of information where they went through detailed tablets of stuff that they should not have known about, what you get is a bigger picture of knowledge that's being passed down. Now, I'm not saying that everybody of the culture knew this information. We know at least two people knew it: the God, who then transcribed it to a scribe, and the scribe who wrote it. We don't know if everybody in the culture knew this stuff.
All right. You know, The Abydos tablets, you've seen those, right, from Egypt?
Yes, the glyphs that look like
helicopters, spaceships.
Right.
Spaceships and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Do some of the Sumerian texts and tablets have those kinds of depictions on them?
Oh, yes. There's many ancient depictions of sky vehicles and also the characters. See, what you get is, for example, Inanna Ishtar. You get her being described as a flyer. You get the description of what she puts on, her gear, and then you get a life-size statue of what she looked like with all her gear on, with a helmet and breathing apparatus. And so you have a triple, in this case, with Inanna Ishtar. The description and the flying and the vehicle, all of this. Plus, there were these things called the Mi. The Mi was basically like, we would think of it as a microchip, where a god stole them in their hand, and they had instruction sets for, well, let's call it the ship or the mission control, and then they had to go chase her to get it, and she shut down operations. I mean, there's stories like that, too. So there's a lot of advanced technology being discussed, but nobody would think of it as technology. The scholars would think of it as just fantasy until Zechariah came around, and he said, wait a second, this is a lot more. They shouldn't have known about this.
He looked at it and said, we've been visited.
Correct. What's funny is that's what every person believes who believes in the Bible. Because remember, God of the Bible is not a human, and it was not born on Earth. By definition, that would be an extraterrestrial.
If he's physical, I guess.
Correct. But if he's not physical, then he's even more of an ET.
Sure.
Because he doesn't even have a physical form. So in Christianity's belief, he would have to produce a child to manifest his essence on Earth. Well, the story of a character who's half human, half God, is a very old story. That's one of the oldest stories that existed.
Now, if somebody looked at these tablets, though, Eric, would they also possibly misinterpret them as some fancy, some artwork?
Well, you can always misinterpret something and call it you can say, hey, it's not what my eyes think it is. A person can have a block, because this kind of information can destroy the foundational belief system that they have and maybe convince them that everything they've ever been taught has been incorrect. So then they could see something and then not see what other people see. A person who's open-minded could say, hey, it's possible. Angels are coming down, interacting with humans, giving them commands. Wars are being started. It's obviously a story of humans having involvements with ETs. Some people say God and angels. You see, you can label it anything you want, but the story remains. If you believe these stories in the Bible, well, then you have to believe the source material of the Bible as well.
See, I'm a believer in the Greek gods, that they were extraterrestrials as well.
Well, and the Greek gods are, George, just borrowed from Phoenician sources, because the Phoenicians came and taught the Greeks. And the Phoenicians were the people where our language of Hebrew comes from. The description of the letters, the sounds of the letters, and the names of the letters are Phoenician names. And they copied the stories that were the Mesopotamian stories that existed, by the way, for thousands of years before it got to the Greeks.
So the Greek mythology could be just based on ancient stories.
Well, in fact, it is. A lot of it has consistencies with stories that we're familiar with. You've got the brothers fighting. You've got the son who was killed or, you know, reborn, avenging the death. You've got Zeus and lightning bolts. I mean, you have a lot of these things that are consistent with the Sumerian stuff and other things that come later in other cultures.
All right, give me your take based on Zechariah's work. What happened? Let's go all the way back.
Okay, if you think about the origin of our solar system happening 4.5 billion years ago, and then you consider that if life started on another planet in our solar system before us, it happened as fast as a snap. One snap of your finger is how much more these other people from a different planet became advanced and had the ability to have space travel. So they only beat us by a few 100,000 years. So he thinks about 450,000 years ago, these beings came here from the planet Nibiru, and they were advanced enough to travel through space, but only through the solar system, not from a different solar system. We're talking about neighbors within our system. They came here because their planet was losing heat, and they came to get raw materials. For a couple 100,000 years, they were mining and getting the materials they needed, and then there was a revolt. And the revolt is clearly described, and they complained, and so the leaders decided to make a primitive worker. And then they created humans, who they called Lulu Amelo, which was a mixed-up being. The word Lulu still existing in our current language to describe somebody who's mixed up. And we were created just like them, and the first model man was named Adamu, which is Adam.
Right. Good point.
And the stories of these creations are consistent with the biblical stories of blood and clay and flesh and the God giving a spirit or a soul into the being. So basically, humans were created to help the gods do work, which is what the Bible says. But the Bible says it was to work in the garden. Well, the Sumerians say it was to work in the mines and other sources for the gods. And then there's descriptions of what happened during these times. And then what happens is it comes down to natural disasters, where after the Great Flood, the Anunnaki and the leadership of these beings decide that they need humans as partners, not just to dominate them, not slaves, but they need priest kings and other people to help them manage the growing population of humans. Apparently, we grew really quickly, and Enlil, whose brother was Enki, Enlil did not really like humans as much, and Enki favored humans and had many children from human females, by the way, which is a reason why the flood was given, which was to destroy the mixed up beings who God did not like, which were hybrids. And so you have a situation where they decided to have humans be their partners. But family squabbles led to priest kings and wars. They went to war in the name of this god. They went to war in the name of this god. Eventually, most of them left. The reasons they left actually are very interesting. There is evidence from some tablets that they left because they were becoming older. Grandchildren were becoming older than their grandparents. Because on Nibiru, whose average orbit is 3,600 years, their time span of life, if they lived 100 orbits, they would live 36,000, you know, 360,000 of our years. But when they came to Earth, we zip around the sun so fast, they became subjected to a faster time frame, and they became really old. So there was a time where a lot of them left. The last one or two times Nibiru was nearby. Now, these beings were not so advanced that they could just jump off of Earth and get to Nibiru at any moment. They used Mars as a station in between. They didn't necessarily come to Earth when Nibiru was closest to us. They would have to jump off early, and then Nibiru would come around, and they would have to get back on again in the opposite way. And we know this from a visit that Anu and Antu, which was the chief king and his wife, visited Earth at the time frame of the beginning of the Hebrew calendar, 5,764 years ago, approximately. So we have kind of an indication of time of when Nibiru was closest or at least nearby enough to visit from a couple orbits ago.
Oh, that sounds exciting and fascinating. Stay with us, Eric. Much more to talk with you about right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Do you think many stories in the Bible, the First Testament at least, the Old Testament, reflected information that the Sumerians had, Eric?
Oh, yeah. There's actually no doubt about it. Some of the stuff that I lecture on and Zechariah lectures on, we can see direct copies from stories that were from much older sources. And in some cases, because nobody knew about this for so many thousands of years, they got away with it. It was plagiarism.
You couldn't sue then, though, could you?
No, but it wasn't done with malice. It was just that these were stories that were known for thousands of years.
They wanted to pass them on.
And they did, and each culture passed them on. And when you get to, let's say, the Moses era, where Alexandria, Egypt has a library, and all the library has is the knowledge of the whole world, okay, and everything that existed up to the time is stored there. So Moses, let's say, was brought up as a prince of Egypt. He would have had access to all this knowledge. Well, what's funny is a lot of the Moses stories are borrowed. His birth story is the same as Sargon the Great, king of Akkadia.
Good point. You're right.
You know, born in secret, put into a basket, left to float in the river, found by a noble person and raised to be the king, and in Moses' case, the king of the Hebrews. Moses turning the Nile River to blood, that was done by Inanna Ishtar thousands of years earlier. There's just so many details of stories. Now, some of the stories are unique, like Moses taking his followers out and the plagues and all this, but the plagues themselves are not all originals. And so you have to question then, which material, which is original stories and which is not? But you can see the source of so many of them. The Tower of Babel, the flood, the creation of humans.
Why weren't we taught this years ago, Eric?
Well, okay, two possible reasons. One, to maintain the ideology or the dogma that we have the answer, we know what happened to our history. And two, we didn't know that there was an alternative view until these tablets were found. Because you have to study outside of your comfort level into areas of archaeology. And these tablets, by the way, are all over different museums and colleges and universities around the world. The French dug some up, the British did, Yale did, Philadelphia University did, so they're all over. Well, it only comes to the 20th century, the 1940s and 50s, when you have Samuel Noah Kramer, who's the preeminent sumerologist of his era, combining and finding out and realizing, hey, these stories, these tablets are the same. Some of them were broken. He had to translate them. It could take a month to translate one tablet. And like I said, they found so many, they found a million tablets, and most of them are administrative. But the ones that have to do with the history, mythology, or the stories of the gods, they weren't always translated so quickly. Most of the archaeologists and historians were, doing Assyrian or Babylonian. But when they found the older tablets, it took one specific person to realize this, and then that became his specialty. And it took, like Jason said regarding dissemination, it took 40, 50 years to disseminate where we can talk about it now, having a big foundation of evidence behind what I'm saying. I have books and books of shelves of these tablets translated, some from the New York Metropolitan Museum in New York. Three books that are 2 inches thick, each one of them has everything in their library translated. Well, you know, unless you read it all yourself, you don't necessarily know what's in there. But lately, I think the paradigm is changing now, and it's very obvious to see the progression of language and the progression of stories is very easy to document now.
The technology that they had, and let's assume they fought here. In India, I was talking to Michael Cremo about this. He's our guest Wednesday night. In India, they describe what could be a nuclear fight between people on this planet. Might that have been the Anunnaki?
Oh, yes, it's quite possible. The Anunnaki in the Sumerian stories are the only beings that are here on Earth. That doesn't mean, or the only alien beings that are here on Earth. That doesn't mean that that is the case. There could have been other groups here. But the stories of nuclear fighting or fighting to have big explosions is something familiar to people who know the Bible, because Sodom and Gomorrah were two cities that were destroyed by balls of fire or hail and brimstone.
Sure.
So we have evidence of this, and there's evidence on the ground in the area where Sodom and Gomorrah is thought to be of black, burnt-out type stones and rocks, and there's no lava or volcano activity in the area, and there's nothing to account for this type of change in the geology of those areas, except we have a story which happens to match the timing and the dating of when Abraham left, and everything seems to connect perfectly to 2025 B.C. And then you have the Lament tablets, which are talking about, oh, the civilization was destroyed, but the buildings were not destroyed, but the people were killed. And there was a death cloud that came and went over the cities and destroyed things. So it would seem to indicate the kind of thing that we would call a nuclear disaster. It may have been a different technology, but it's the same effect. Buildings are not destroyed, but the people are killed. So this kind of evidence doesn't only exist in India. It also exists in Mesopotamia.
Well, that may be absolutely true. So are there other people like Zechariah out there who have investigated these Sumerian texts?
Well, sure. Right now there's many of them, and there's many authors now who talk about it. I work with Zechariah, so I tend to stick mostly with his stuff, but I buy a lot of corroborating type of books or evidence of scholars. Mostly, though, we look at stuff that's even older than Zechariah's. Because the problem now is that anybody who writes after will use Zechariah as a source. So when I studied Zechariah's material, I actually studied his sources. So I went back to Samuel Noah Kramer and Stephen Langdon and old professors who originally dug up the tablets. And I wanted to see what they thought and what they translated. And the more I went back and the more I saw, the more I realized Zechariah's way of looking at it was correct.
What did some of the original people say?
Well, I have a book here, I mean, just a simple little book, which talks about the calendars. And so the calendar has all the holidays that we're all familiar with from the Bible, talks about the months and the names of the months and things that the king should do, and he shouldn't start a war on this day, and he should stay close to his castle on that day. Well, it turns out that a lot of these days, December 25th, or in the Hebrew calendar, Yom Kippur, or the New Year, Rosh Hashanah, all of these holidays have been holidays for thousands of years. They've always been important days. And just because another historical event happened on a day doesn't mean that something didn't happen prior to that. So that's what happens when you go back in time and you're looking at the archaeological record. What you're seeing is there's nothing new. It's all being copied from something more.
Is there anything in those tablets that you don't agree with in terms of what the Zechariah has done? Or do you believe what his interpretations are, you know, totally?
Well, I have we do have a disagreement whether the Yahweh character of the Bible was a real physical being, and he consumed food and ate, like the Anunnaki gods were known to do. And by the way, the Anunnaki gods would only eat from gold bowls or gold cups.
Oh, really? Why?
Yep. Well, they were picky.
Fussy, yeah.
And it may have been their biology. We don't know. It could have been that they were allergic to other things. We don't know how pure they were necessarily and what kind, you know, how pure they wanted their food and drink. Also, they would not eat meat before midday. And that's a funny thing. Jews only would eat like salmon or fish in the morning, but never meat. Like, it's a popular thing to have sausage or bacon in the morning. But for some reason, the Hebrew people won't do that. And Anunnaki didn't have meat before midday. So when Moses was in the desert with Yahweh's cloud over him and they were traveling with his tabernacle, they were giving sacrifices. So I always thought, well, maybe the sacrifices were meant to give food and nourishment to the god. So that's kind of a disagreement that we're not, you know, there's no evidence that Yahweh actually consumed. But yet, the story after the flood is that he smelled the pleasing aroma of the sacrifice that Noah was giving. Now, I know that the story is actually talking about the other Anunnaki gods who did consume. So the question is, what characteristics were Yahweh only, and what characteristics were picked up from the prior gods' descriptions?
Wouldn't you have liked to have lived during that era, Eric? My gosh.
Well, to have seen it firsthand, yeah. I would have loved to see some of the miracles and some of these events that happened. But you know what's funny, George? Even though these Israelites witnessed the 10 plagues and everything that the God did for them,
sure,
they still didn't believe. They still had a problem with their faith. They seem to have always had a problem with their faith, even though they were witnessing the stuff firsthand. And I always found that very interesting.
Would these beings, obviously, they came down in craft?
Yes, they were physical craft, chemical or fuel-based. And we know this because their landing sites and their launching sites are gigantic stone platforms throughout the ancient world. Baalbek, Lebanon is one of them, an example of gigantic stones. And, you know, I've been to Malta. I've been to the pyramids. I just don't know why ancient man has to work with such gigantic stone blocks. What's the point?
What if there were giants here?
Well, see, that's funny. That is very possible because the actual word for giant in Hebrew is Anakim.
Oh, really?
Which is Anak. Now, you have the Anunnaki and you have Enki. And if you think of the word without vowels, because back then they didn't have vowels as letters, they used little dots and lines for vowels. You have basically A-N-K is Anaki, giant, Enki, or Anunnaki.
Does the word Nephilim ever come up in the Sumerian tablets?
Not that word, because that's from an Akkadian root. But okay, the word Nephilim means two different things. It means from the root Nephal, those who've come down, okay, which is the same meaning as Anunnaki, those
right,
who from heaven to earth came. So you have Anakim, the sound of Anunnaki, meaning the word giant in Hebrew. Then you have the translation of what Anunnaki means becoming the same meaning as the word Nephilim. This is how we can translate and go back in time through the language. One word in Hebrew keeps the meaning, and one word in Hebrew keeps the sound of the original word. And it becomes two different words. I'll give you another example, like
please,
the word Adam. Adam is man. But Adam is also a compound word. It means dam, blood. Adam is red. Adama means clay, and it's red clay. And so Adam's name encompasses red, earth, clay, and blood.
That is something.
And so that's why you
good
get
interpretation.
So Hebrew picks up not just the sound of the words, but the meanings of several words and puts them into a single root. And then you have the root then puts things on the end of it or in the front of it.
What about the misinterpretations? I bet that's out there too, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The biggest misinterpretation, George, is the first time the word God was used in the ancient Sumerian stories and didn't even mean God. The original word for God was Dingir, and Din is the word righteous or holy, like Eden, right? The Garden of Eden. Well, E means house, and Din means justice or righteous, so it's really a house of judgment, like where the king or the court would be. But Dingir means righteous ones of the fiery, flashy object thing that goes to the sky. So they were describing astronauts or people who flew in vehicles, and guess what? Dingir got translated to Akkadian to mean the word God. Originally, it meant righteous ones of the sky chamber or the flashy, fiery object thing. So the first mistranslation created the word God.
First mistranslation created the word God, but then it got carried through.
That's correct.
Why?
Well, because the word worked. In other words, when Akkadian translated from the original Sumerian Dingir into Elu or El, Ilani and Aluti, which are the Hebrew or Semitic forms of the word God, it meant lofty ones. It didn't even mean God. It meant lofty ones, those who are above us, higher, flying, more spiritual, more knowledgeable, more technologically advanced, the givers of knowledge. But we later translate it to be God. If you could take out, and by the way, in English, when you see the Bible, it says the Lord this and God that. In Hebrew, each of these words doesn't mean that. They use the name of Yahweh. They use the word Elohim. They use different words which become Lord or God in English. So that's why learning the Bible in Hebrew gives you a very different perspective. And then going back even farther gives you another perspective. That's quite incredible.
So the Anunnaki pack up and leave. They go back to their planet. Why? Why simply give up and take off? Why not stay?
Well, there is evidence that some stayed behind, and there's evidence that some died on Earth. Like there's a royal tomb and cemetery in Ur, where they found a female Anunnaki and her husband. And the measurements of this body is very unusual, very large heads and very large boned. So there is some physical evidence that some of them stayed behind. Some of them stayed behind because they didn't mind getting old. They liked their lives. But most of them felt they were higher above than humans. Humans were a creation of theirs, and so it's like living among the animals from their point of view. I wouldn't say they were stuck up, but I would say that they felt that they were a higher level being, and they didn't want to be stuck with low-level creations, because humans became so many humans were created and born that we overwhelmed them.
I always have wondered if they were banned from their own planet and sent here.
Well, in the beginning, it seems that the first few that came, that was the case with Alalu. That's what the stories say. He was trying to escape Anu when they had a fight for supremacy. But later on, when they discovered that there was resources here, they came willingly. Of course, the story that covers the Igigi, and the Igigi are the astronauts that are not the ruling class, these guys were tired of their job. These are the ones that revolted and complained that they were doing too much work, and they were the ones who came down and had a lot of interactions with humans. So you get a little bit of everything. You get one side of the clan, the Enki clan, liking humans, and you get the Enlil clan not liking humans. And it's kind of like the Bible, where the flood is given to destroy humans, but then Noah's told to build an ark so humanity is saved. Then you have the Tower of Babel, which God didn't like, but then he split up the languages. So you get this split personality where one side likes humans and one side punishes them and one side gives them another chance, and it goes back and forth.
Well, you've done some great work here, Eric, and tell me anything new coming up with your work with Zechariah?
Well, he's always putting up something new. Right now we're going to be putting up something about Mars very soon.
And oh, really? What's happening
Mars
there?
Just some interesting, what would they call blueberries, is a iron oxide material that's on Mars, shown by those little robots.
Right, right.
Rovers. Rovers, which proves, first of all, that water was involved in forming this geology. So it may not be absolutely new to, to people that follow this very closely.
Hoagland might know about it already, huh?
Uh-huh. Also, people who study it know that. Also, Zechariah's new book, The Journey to the Mythical Past, talked about paths pathways in the Great Pyramid that were previously unknown before, that he was involved in, that he never released before, where somebody went from one of our groups actually walked inside one of these tunnels. And this guy is big. He's 6'2" or so, and he got in as far as he could. And there's some pictures of that in Zechariah's recent book. What's happening is he's now releasing all of his little tidbits of information that he gathered, you know, through his travels, and finally coming out with all the stuff that he may not have talked about before.
Well, Eric, you know, the subject of the visitation to me is one of the greatest. I had an astronomer try to look for that 3,600-year elliptical orbit of Nibiru, and he wasn't able to find it. But Zechariah, in his book, The 12th Planet, kind of pinpoints it pretty well, I think.
He pinpoints it from that 1976 and 77 time frame. One, because there was an observation in a tablet around 555 BC where they observed it in a certain constellation, and so he knew from that time frame it was there. Then Zechariah went to meet Professor Harrington at the U.S. Naval Observatory, who was doing work on the perturbations of, you know, Neptune and Uranus, and projected that there was another planet out there. And if you account for the brown dwarf, you then have, you know, another reason to look in a certain area, and he thought that he pinpointed it. Unfortunately, Dr. Harrington died, but his research, at least what he wrote, was left behind, of course. And, you know, there have been multiple sightings throughout the historical record of this, you know, 10th planet or Nibiru coming through our solar system, coming close to Earth.
Sure.
So it's not an historical fact until our civilization sees it live. But as far as the historical record is concerned, it's an historical fact.
Well, it sure is. Eric, stay with us. We're going to keep you, and then we'll bring Jason Martell back on for your phone calls. Next on Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie. Okay, this is the time we're going to take your phone calls with our guests Jason Martell and Eric Parker. So we'll be back with both of them and you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We've got Eric Parker, Jason Martell, and your phone calls. Jason, were you able to hear a little bit of Eric last hour?
Oh, he's stealing the show.
Nah, but you guys are similar, very similar in what you're doing and talking about.
You know what, George, I'll tell you what, real quickly, Eric and I have talked about this, and just I want to quickly, since we have such a great audience here, Eric and I are planning some very big things, and hopefully in the coming months, we're going to be able to do some very interesting things via the Internet and live TV, and maybe, and of course, with Coast to Coast, but
of course,
some very interesting real-time experiments and exposure to this information with physical evidence.
Well, so, I got to tell you, this is an incredible story. When you tie in, you know, the chapters of Genesis with the Anunnaki and the various ancient writings, man, something happened on this planet, you two, a long time ago, huh?
Good stuff.
Yep. Let's take some calls. Let's go to our wild card line. We'll pick it up with you, Michael, on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George.
Hi.
Hey, this is Michael calling from Sacramento.
Great, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, I have two questions. I want to ask Jason one and Eric one.
All right.
Okay.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay, my first question is to Jason. Is it possible,
yes,
Jason, do you think UFOs that we're seeing nowadays, do you think that they are coming to Earth and they have something to do with the Anunnaki, or maybe descendants of the Anunnaki?
The only answer that I could give to relate towards modern-day ufology is that we do see one similarity in the fact that there were figurines, Sumerian figurines, which have a very strong resemblance to the modern-day gray. And the only thing that I hypothesize, because there are Sumerian tablets, and Eric can speak to this too if he'd like, that describe these beings as that acted as if they were human but were not, and assisted the Anunnaki. So I postulate that if the Anunnaki did create us in their image and after their likeness were some grand experiment, why not genetically alter or have some other race of beings here overseeing their grand experiment, genetically, reproductively, and relaying this information back to the Anunnaki about how we're progressing? That's just a hypothetical answer that I could give you.
That is a great answer, exactly. The second question, if I could, to Eric, I guess, do you think the Anunnaki had anything to do with the Hall of Records or the face on Mars or the pyramids on Mars?
Well, the face on Mars could resemble the first Anunnaki who visited Earth. His name was Alalu. And the pyramids would be very consistent with all these structures that we find on Earth. What's unique about these gigantic stone structures and the pyramids is that they're always made with astronomical alignments, as Jason said in the first hour. They are also, they have the ability to either possibly magnify the Earth's energy or the magnetic fields, and they're not made by accident in the shape that they're in. I mean, these are not easy structures to create. So I just see it as a consistent architectural design, and I would definitely think that if there's real pyramids on Mars, and we could confirm that, there's going to be some connection with the Earth pyramids as well.
Okay, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
How's it going, George?
Good. Jeremy, good.
My question is, do you think that the Anunnaki are capable of traveling via something called the Merkabah, the vehicle of light?
We don't see evidence from the historical record that they traveled in anything but fuel-based or visually physical objects. Now, to get light travel or beings of light that comes from different sources, let's say the Billy Meyer contact talks about this type of travel.
I believe I've seen it right here in Pittsburgh, December 3rd. Me and two other people saw it.
What, 2007?
Yes. No, 2007, this year we saw it. And it was mind-blowing. It literally looked like a stargate in the sky, about 3,000 feet up in the sky. And it was cloth, like, it was behind a cloud, but it shined so brightly through, it looked like a star, like, at 3,000 feet. And it was completely silent for 30 seconds. We watched it with, like, a halo of blue and red lights flashing above it. It was amazing. It's probably the most insane thing I've ever seen in my life.
Have either one of you two have seen anything like that?
I have not seen a light. I saw a giant donut in the sky that went over West Hollywood back in 99, and it was silent.
Other witnesses to that?
One friend of mine.
How about you, Jason?
Similar situation. That's what initially sparked my interest 13 years ago into the research was a personal sighting with a friend of mine that no object I could classify as a bird or a plane fit the description, so it, had kind of a little switch of a flip, mentally for me to want to understand what I, was seeing, and here we are today.
Do you think the fallen angels of Genesis might be the Anunnaki?
Well, the Anunnaki actually referred to the whole group of beings that came from this planet Nibiru,
right?
But it also kind of referred to the ruling class, the command class. The Igigi was the name of the regular crewmen that were the astronauts. So, yeah, they were all from the same planet, but they didn't have the same rank. But, George, there's something like several hundred billion galaxies in the universe, and I find it very unusual that people would believe that we're the only life forms here, and we've been broadcasting signals out into space since the 1940s and 30s. I think people are coming to take a look at us.
Yeah, I think it's changing now. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello?
George?
Yeah, hi.
George? Oh, a great topic. Love it.
Me too.
Okay, I was reading the Bible, and it talks about Enoch and how Enoch was taken by the angels into the solar system and shown the planets. Also, if you read the book of Enoch, it talks about the fallen angels and how they had given the people knowledge of writing, weapons, metal, herbs for medicine, etc. Just like how your guest was speaking about the Anunnaki teaching the people knowledge in math and sciences. And could this all be coming to date, because a lot of people I speak with today, like past guests, have talked about this sense of urgency or panic or something about to happen, and just people just can't really put their finger on it.
Well, you have a couple things happening on Earth. One is the change of zodiacal age into the age of Aquarius, which every zodiacal age changing creates some kind of, let's say, apprehension in people. If you have Nibiru coming close, then there may be gravitational fields that are coming and affecting our planet.
Okay.
So there could be a factor of all of these things happening and more.
One little piece, I'm sorry, just a quick thing I throw out there too for you is that, as Eric mentioned about the zodiacal breakdown of the heaven into 12 parts, the way that works is if you go out during helichelial sunrising, just before the sun is about to come up over the horizon, you can see which constellation the sun is rising in front of, and you'd say, we are in the age of Pisces or the age of Aquarius.
Well, how would the 13th sign that Nostradamus talked about, playing effect with that.
Well, I have no comment for you on that one.
Just as far as he would be seeing a change in some kind of pattern, or let's say a change in a vibrational energy form. The age of Aquarius is the water bearer, so it's the bearer of knowledge, the bearer of new information. So this is something that people have also felt, actually, for the last 40, 50 years.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. Hello there. Carol, you're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
St. Petersburg, Florida.
Okay, go ahead, Carol.
And for Eric, who do you think that Jehovah, the Bible, Yahweh, do you think it was Anu or Enki or Enil?
Uh-huh.
Does anybody know what you're
Well, here's the problem. He appears to have the characteristics of both of them, depending on what part of the story that you're talking about. In the case of the flood, he's both. Enlil wants to get rid of the humans, and Enki wants to save them. And in the case of the Tower of Babel, same situation. The Tower of Babel is not an original Bible story. In the original story, it's Enlil who gets upset with the people. And Enki, Enlil wants to get rid of them, and then Enki has a compromise, and they spread their languages. So you always seem to have both characteristic traits being put into a compound character of Yahweh. So he's both.
Okay. What about Moses? What was that God? Do you think which one he was when he gave the Ten Commandments? Is that both too?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, in the case of the Ten Commandments, then Yahweh would be more like Enki than Enlil because he would be giving rules to govern humanity. And the rules we consider to be positive rules, not like anything negative. But again, there's a lot of old depictions like the Law Code of Hammurabi, where Hammurabi is getting and dictating from a certain god a set of rules, which later on those rules end up in the Moses Law Code. A lot of them are borrowed and copied. Eye for an eye, for example, is a copy from the Law Code of Hammurabi. So that's a different god. That's I forget the name right now. So there's different depictions and different descriptions.
Okay, thank you very much. Jason, do you and Eric do any conferences or anything like that?
We do occasionally speak on various shows, and we do, you know, plan, as I was stating earlier, plan on having a conference actually in L.A., hopefully by the end of this year, mm-hmm. maybe with a couple other gentlemen like Lloyd Pye, and to do kind of a conference, you know, like the Conscious Life Expo style, but we're going to specifically focus on Planet X and the Sumerian culture.
Okay, let's go back to the phones east of the Rockies. Hello there.
Yes. Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
John. John from Sterling Heights, Michigan.
Ah, of course, John. Go ahead, please.
Hey, I kind of had two things. I've been following this stuff for like the last 10 years from the Graham Hancock, Robert Bouval books, you know, on the fingerprints of the gods and that kind of thing. And on this thing here, my question was, has... Eric or Jason ever heard of like the number code of like the Sumerians worshipped women as goddesses and gave them the number 9, which would represent like 9 months to give birth. And then if you were to like multiply that by the heartbeat is like 60 seconds in a minute, and then you would multiply that by like 12 months in the year, and then multiply that by 24 days, multiply that times 2 of the human, male, female, come up with the number, then divide that by the rate or by the precession of the Earth, which is 1 degree every 72 years, you come up with 4,320, which is the pyramid, the Great Pyramid radius. And if you were to multiply that by 10, like representing planet X, the 10th planet, you come up with 43,200, which is the total polar radius of the Earth.
Sir, I think you need to speak to Richard Hoagland in 19.5 degrees. That was a long equation.
There's a lot of calculations in there, sir. If you just take some of these astronomical or precessional numbers, like 43,200, and you divide it by the amount of zodiacal years in each age, which is 2160, you would have 20 zodiacal cycles equal to 43,200.
Right, right, right.
So what you get is 10 fingers and 10 toes, which is our basic structure of human. 10
yes.
fingers and toes times the amount of zodiacal ages is that 43,200 number.
Yes.
So what happens is you don't have to use all of those calculations to get there. They left
right.
behind a very easy mathematical system that connects their sexagesimal system with our base 10.
Which is actually 6 and 10, two separate numbers, the
correct.
Sumerian math system.
Right. Oh, it's so fascinating. I've been sitting here doing these kind of different equations, and my thing was just, you know, the 9 months to give birth, the heart rate, the, you know, the dumb amount of days. They really knew.
John, 43,200 yeah. is also 12 cycles of the orbit of Nibiru. The 3,600 times
right.
12 is 43,200, and 2,160, the amount of years
wow.
of the zodiacal age, times 20 is the same 43,200. That's why their mathematical system works so well. It connected base 10, which we use, with what they use, and it makes calculations of large numbers very easy.
Right. And how else could they have done what they did with the Great Pyramids and representing them? Could the Anunnaki been associated with the Orion constellation, planet X, be out in that area?
Well, if it was in that area, it would be an observation at a certain point.
Okay.
Since it orbits our sun and possibly the brown dwarf, it gets near there, it only appears in Orion at some period of time.
Oh, but it does.
It could.
Yeah. Wow. My other one real quick thing here was just that I wanted to elaborate on that last caller's thing. Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
John, are you there?
Where do you go?
I think we lost.
We lost the elaboration.
Okay. All right, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line here at Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Aaron in Seattle.
Hey, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thanks for having me. I find the fascinating the interpretation of religion and with the Anunnaki and aliens. So my question was if they might have had anything to do with the development of Buddhism, which isn't technically really a religion. It's more philosophy or science of mind. And if maybe that was a fully human development, or if there was influences on it, or Hinduism really seems right for it. That is really technically a religion, but Buddhism itself is really a philosophy. There's not really any worship in it. So I was wondering if there was maybe any influence.
Okay,
on
which
that.
One of you two wants that?
Jason, do you want to talk?
Well, the only thing I can answer the caller is in the regard of saying that there are actually much older texts than even Sumerian, Indian texts, for instance, that talk, you know, Vedic texts that speak of vimanas that used to come down and flying craft and all types of interesting things that happen from the Vedic texts, which are much, you know, we're talking like 10,000 years old. So, you know, I'm sure there is a crossover with some of this information from other cultures, which, if they're more technologically advanced, they're also going to be more spiritually advanced and bequeath information in those regards. But I specifically have focused on the Sumerian culture and really have not had the time yet in my life to divulge further into other cultures at this magnitude.
Aaron, have you heard of a Brahma in the ancient...
Yeah, he's listening on his radio now.
Oh, okay. Well, Brahma, if you add an A to the front of Brahma, you have Abraham. There's a very strong connection to the king lists of the Sumerian king lists and the ancient Indian Vedic text king lists. The connection is so strong that some of them share the same names, plus or minus a letter in the beginning or a sound or a vowel in the beginning or the end. There's a very strong connection that Inanna Ishtar went over to the Indian area. And other places. I've been studying Easter Island script to see if that also connects with some of Indus Valley script.
You know, if the people from Nibiru, the Anunnaki, had the capability of coming to this planet thousands of years ago, they must have gone to other planets as well, don't you think?
They did, for sure. It's recorded.
We know they went to Mars because there's evidence of that in the record of the descriptions.
Did they have a civilization there, or did they just merely use it as a base?
A way station, transport.
Yeah, we describe more of a way station, which would be a temporary residence. There's evidence that indicates that Mars had natural disasters and wiped out not only part of their atmosphere, but the water, you know, froze up. So it wouldn't have been a good place for long-term civilization. But they definitely went all over the planet Earth because there's evidence and consistent structures all over this planet.
And George, to be honest, you know, my personal feeling about what possibly is happening on Mars in relation to structures or any, you know, physical evidence left by the Anunnaki, there are tablets. One of Sisson's latest books, The Lost Book of Enki, is a record by the one of the Anunnaki, you know, various languages telling this story, but the concise version of it told by Zachariah is that, you know, one of these Anunnaki actually, his memorialized face was left on the surface. That's the face on Mars.
I love it. I love it.
There has to be some type of connection, and the only thing I'd throw out there, NASA, you know,
Administration and Space Administration.
Thank you. My tongue is tied there. They have not always had the best track record for showing us the complete record of what's going on Mars. So I don't personally trust only the data that we have. These stories in conjunction with the data shed light to say that maybe the story and the pictures painted by Mars today aren't physically actually what everything is encompassing up there. There
All
could
right.
be things there today that they're not showing.
I think you're both right. Come back now next with Final Calls. Welcome back. Jason and Eric, before we go back to Final Calls, how about you, Jason? Take a moment or two. I'd like you to just summarize your position here.
Yes, sir. Well, just as an overall broad format, you know, what I have taken the position on is that all throughout history, there are pieces of ancient technology which paint a picture for us that, for instance, extraterrestrial visitation or some type of advanced technology has been part and present in our past and is echoed throughout many cultures. So what we see is described as mythology from all the different cultures around the world. I've taken the standpoint that these are not mythological tales, and using modern science, we can start to confirm many of the things they were discussing. So we have to start to look at that line in the sand, as I referred to earlier, and say, is it possible that extraterrestrials do in fact exist? And if so, they probably have been here a lot longer than we have.
Okay. How about you, Eric?
Well, it's funny, as I'm going to cover something in the solar system. The evidence that this solar system has been bombarded with visitors or nemesis like Nibiru and its orbiting debris that comes with it is interesting. A lot of people don't know this, that Venus spins retrograde to the rest of the planets in our solar system, which means the sun does not rise in the east and set in the west. The sun rises in the west and sets in the east over there. So it spins the opposite direction. Uranus is laying on its side. Its magnetic field is up and down compared to every other planet, which has a little bit more to the ecliptic plane. And Miranda, moon of Uranus, is just simply scarred with bombarded. It just looks like it's scarred by constant bombardment as well as the moon. So I think that the solar system shows a lot of evidence and weird things around it that not many people talk about, which shows that possibly Nibiru and its orbiting debris have come and gone millions of times through our history.
Okay, back to Final Calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi there, George.
Hi.
My name is John. I'm calling from Newport Beach, California.
Okay, John.
Also own some property in Stephenville.
Oh, yes. You do?
Yes. So I have several friends there, and, of course, there's been a lot of activity. And so I have basically two questions.
Okay.
One is, I was raised in a very strict religious biblical home, and I've come to believe over the years that the Bible and science should be complementary, not at odds with each other. I want to hear comments about that. And the other thing is, have we totally ruled out that at least some of this aircraft is advanced aircraft that our government, maybe some other governments, have developed together? And maybe they're in contact, or maybe they've gained this technology from visitors, extraterrestrial visitors.
Okay, who wants to take those?
I think I'll start real quickly. I'm sure Eric would like to comment too. Yes, and yes to the answers call. To the question. The technology that we're seeing is definitely evidence for, you know, things that we're doing now. We've seen things like the TR-3B and various other craft that the government more than likely is testing, and it's likely that these are also sightings that take place by people who misinterpret it as an alien spacecraft.
True. Before Area 51 was closed off, there was tons of photography of weird things flying around there that were definitely, you know, experiments by our military. But I'm not sure if those military are also flying over populated cities with top secret aircraft. So a lot of the stuff that is seen is going to be something that is completely off of, you know, from off of the earth. The Bible and science have to blend together because not one side or the other has a complete 100% monopoly on the story. There is going to be a blend somewhere in the middle.
Thank you very much.
That's my opinion on that.
Okay, very good. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Hello there, Buck. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello, George. You're doing a heck of a job. And Jason and Eric, I'm calling not with a question, but I'm calling to agree with you wholeheartedly. I happen to be a Raelian, and we believe in exactly what you're saying. And just like the last caller said, there has to be the Bible and science can't be at odds. In fact, they do agree if you look close enough, as you have noticed. And I'm going to spend only a couple of seconds here, but can you hear me?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Now, the problem originally started, like you said, with the misinterpretation of the Bible, where the original Hebrew version did not say God. It said Elohim, and you said that. And we believe in the Elohim. In fact, we believe the Elohim are one of many that have done experiments on planets that have made humans in their own image. And so we believe that the Elohim created us on this particular planet, and I'm told they also tried it on two additional planets, which I don't know much about. Now, I'm going to move along fast here, but in the Bible, it does, the very first sentence says, God created heaven and earth. Well, if you take it back to the Elohim created, Elohim means those who came from the sky, is what I'm told, or those who came from above. You tried to explain it earlier. It's those who are more knowledgeable or those, and it's plural, definitely plural. So the God thing is we don't believe, we're atheists and we don't believe in God. And secondly, in the first a few experiments, they made them so much identical that they would live to be 700 years old. And that's why when you read the first part in Genesis, it talks about such so-and-so lived to be 700 and so years, and so-and-so lived, and his son lived to be 700. Well, it's true. They did live to be 700 years. But what happened was that the Elohim became somewhat concerned that we would gain too much knowledge by living so long. So they changed something in our DNA that shortened our life down to 70 years average instead of 700 years. And there have always been sort of, I'm going to say, paranoid that we would come back to them. In fact, the Tower of Babel actually was a rocket, a chemical rocket that they were trying to build to get back to the Elohim. And let's see what else here. The covenant. The original covenant was when is everybody still there?
Yep, we're all listening.
Okay, the covenant, remember the Ark of the Covenant's a big deal. Well, the original covenant was when the Elohim discovered that they themselves were created by some people that were created in someone else's image. And so when they realized that they were created in someone's image, they decided not to interfere with our affairs anymore. And that was a long time ago, and they have not interfered since. But they have been trying to sort of like nudge us to become more elevated consciousness, because there's been many, many prophets, and Jesus is included. I mean, I'm talking about Jesus, Muhammad, even Gandhi was a prophet in himself, and Buddha, and the latest is Rael, who we follow, and these were all people who were sent that are half they're hybrids. They're sent with the same message, and the message is this: if you cannot get along with yourselves on your own planet, how in the heck do you expect to become part of the Federation? So it's just strange that the covenant, they left us alone, to see what we would do. And actually, Satan was one of the people that voted against the whole idea in the first place. That thought that we were bad. You know, what they had created was bad. And being bad meaning that we acquired too much knowledge too fast and misused it.
Eric, very, very close to what you and Jason say.
Yeah, Rael has an interesting story. Some of it I disagree with, like the timeline of only 25,000 years of these Elohim being on Earth and creating thousands of species in this short time. The archaeological record definitely shows much older life forms. And the Raelian group is interesting as they do not believe in that there's a soul. They're one of the few groups that does not believe that. They believe it's all reincarnation with your memories existing. So they have a very unique belief system.
Okay, thanks for that call, Buck. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. Let's go next to our next wildcard line. TJ in Tucson, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, sir. I have two questions.
Sure.
My first question is, when Planet X appeared in the daytime sky thousands of years ago and it looked like a cross, what were the atmospheric conditions that caused it to look like a cross? And my second question is, the cross has been used as a symbol, a religious symbol, long before Christ ever walked the face of the earth. I was just wondering if this was the origins of that being used as a religious symbol.
I'll give that to you, Eric.
Well, the original source of the cross was the Numerian symbol, but it did not appear to look like a cross in the sky. The cross was more of the symbol in picture form of the translation of Nibiru being the planet of the crossing. Mm-hmm. So it looked like, Jason, was it a red dot or something when they saw it there in the observation? It didn't look like a cross in the sky. That was just the depiction in the artwork.
Just like the Anunnaki being depicted with wings, I seriously doubt they walked on the earth with wings.
Correct. They were just depicted as flyers, the ability to fly and move around like that.
Okay, thanks. Let's go next. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Joe from Grand Rapids.
Hey,
Michigan.
Joe. Hi.
Hi. Good. How you doing? I have a question about 2012. Before I get into that, there's I've read all of Sitchin's books. There's a story about one of the Anunnaki, Nephilim, that got exiled to the far west. And there's a Mayan text that talks about a white-bearded man that traveled from the far east and gave them their astronomical...
Quetzalcoatl.
Yes, Quetzalcoatl. And so I was wondering if it's possible that this whole 2012 thing, because there's a lot of synchronicities going on lately, if it's possible that it's the return of the Nephilim to Earth. Because the serpent god, and I believe like the symbol of Enki was the snake running up the cross, like the medical symbol. And is that possible they worshipped the serpent god because the man that came to them told them about all these things? And if 2012 is the return of the Nephilim to Earth.
All right, who wants that?
I'll take a stab at it real quickly. Earlier in my presentation, I mentioned that on the long count calendar of the Mayans, which was mainly based on predictions that they would make on Bakhtun, certain timetables, they were more or less predictions. So one of these predictions was that Quetzalcoatl was going to return in a predicted date. That date brought about the conquistadors instead of Quetzalcoatl. So I theorize that 2012's demise of the end of time is just a prediction from their long count calendars. And since others have not been fulfilled as they predicted, this prediction for 2012 really doesn't hold much weight. I just take it as a grain of sand as far as will it be another doomsday event, which people are always looking for.
I look at 2012 as the beginning and end of an age or a cycle. All the planets will be aligned on one side of the sun. That may or may not cause some gravitational problem. And then 2013 will begin a new era. It doesn't mean that the old era will end in fire and brimstone. It could just be... There could be no event at all. It could be non-event.
That's possible.
Hopefully, maybe something good.
Hopefully good, yes.
West of the Rockies. Hi, Sally. You're on the air.
Hi. Turn off my radio.
Okay.
I have heard in the past about Zachariah's predictions, things that he has said about positive and negative blood, and that some of the workers had positive blood versus...
like A positive or O positive,
yeah,
or something
A
like
positive
that.
Or versus A negative blood, and that he had a lot that they had something to do with that. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I'm sorry to say I did not have any knowledge of that subject.
I cannot comment as well.
Okay.
Interesting, though.
That's my website. thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Let's take a few more calls, and then we are out of time. Gentlemen, first-time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. Where are you calling from?
I'm a long-time dialer, but the first-time talker.
Okay, thanks. Out of where?
Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, what I would like to ask your guest is, does he think that there is a certain amount of people that know the secret to what is going to come to this world?
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, I would answer it like there's some people who think they know, but since it's predicting the future, we have no way of confirming scientifically if they're accurate or not.
Right, because my feelings are that there, I don't know if it's aliens or anything like that that infiltrated our government and stuff like that that are, you know, behind the shadows of what goes on in our government and stuff like that, that actually know the secret, because my feelings are that there are a few select people that do know the end of time as far as the Earth goes, and that's one of the reasons why we pursue space so much, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, I would answer you, sir, in saying that my personal belief, not what I could substantiate with facts or evidence, is that anything
right.
that you can imagine or postulate has already happened. And there is research
right.
from Corso and various others that show that we are already utilizing and manipulating time travel, and we're on such a changed timeline as it is that I personally believe that, yes, we have seen into the future and, you know, probably have viewed many things of circumstances that could come about. But we've
right.
made changes and done things that we're now on an altered timeline that no one can predict. Just my own personal
right.
opinion.
Do you believe that there is other civilizations?
Sure.
Do you believe that it is possible for us to occupy two dimensions at the same time?
I wouldn't be able to comment. I'd lack of knowledge in that field.
Well, right. Well, if it wasn't for unproven facts, we would have no ambition to pursue life. If you know what I'm saying.
Again, this is all a speculation that can't be proved either way until maybe 100 years in the future or 1,000 years in the future.
Right, because my opinion is and my feeling is that the only difference between us and an advanced civilization is it's us in a later time. And as far as, you know, how the technology was 2,000 years ago with the pyramids and stuff like that, I feel that we're not looking at the past, we're looking at the future.
Well, then we're in a circular time frame, you're saying.
Yes, exactly. I feel that we're looking at the future, and everybody's like, how could they have this technology that we can't even duplicate now, but yet it was so long ago. I feel that we're not looking at the past, we are looking at the future.
George, what's interesting is the only thing I can think about is the Abydos glyphs, which show helicopters. Would be quite interesting evidence for what he's saying.
That's one of the best, too. Hey, both of you, Jason and Eric, thanks
yes,
for
sir.
Being on the program, my friends.
Thank you, George. We'll talk to you again soon,
absolutely.
I'm sure.
Absolutely. Keep in touch.
Take care.
Okay, so that wraps up another one of our coast-to-coast shows for Wayne Roberts, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.